Welcome to the Paediatric Physical Therapy Podcast. I'm Peter Goodwin. Later in this edition, we'll be taking a special look at weight gain and obesity in children. We'll hear about helping children with Down syndrome learn how to ride bikes like the rest of the kids, and how you can use vibration perception to monitor how kids walk with their toes. But first, we'll hear about ankle-foot orthotics. Are they always helpful to help children learn to walk? Well, the answer to that seems to be not in all patients. Christy Bjornsson from Seattle has been studying the effect of using ankle-foot orthoses in children with bilateral cerebral palsy. They randomised patients to 2 weeks using the orthotic, followed by 2 weeks not, with the groups crossing over at the halfway point.
Our team wanted to investigate what happens in community use of orthotics. Orthotics are a very common intervention to optimize walking for children with cerebral palsy. But to date, no one in the literature has really looked at what that effect is on community walking. So we used a walking pedometer, accelerometer, that was able to document the amount, level of walking, as well as the intensity of walking for these children as they wore their orthotics.
Now, this was in cerebral palsy, and you conducted a randomized study.
That is correct. We had a randomized crossover design where the children were randomized to either wear their orthotics for 2 weeks or not wear their orthotic prescription for 2 weeks.
And what happened?
Well, actually, we had a group of 11 children, and when we looked at group effects, we actually found no difference in the amount or intensity of walking between the groups of or the intervention with or without the orthotic. But interestingly, we did find that there were some children who had clearly enhanced walking level and intensity with their orthotics on. Now, what was not controlled in this study was the type of orthotic. What we studied was the clinically prescribed orthotic that the providers caring for these children have prescribed for them. So thus, what we found out is that it appears that the clinically prescribed orthotics are not consistently optimizing community walking.
Now, what's your brief interpretation of these data then?
Well, it suggests that we need to take a better look at how we're prescribing orthotics. If you go to the literature, there is not a consistent application of how we prescribe orthotics, even though they are a common intervention. I think also there were some key characteristics to some of the orthotics where we saw a positive effect on community walking that deserve further study, specifically looking at optimizing shank alignment and modification of shoes. That may be a possible modification of the intervention that might have some positive outcome for community walking activity.
So in brief, how would you advise physical therapists to apply these findings very briefly in practice?
I think, first of all, the clinicians need to take a look at finding ways of trying to measure community walking. It's one thing to watch a child walk in a clinical setting with the orthotics on, but what you really want to know is if this intervention, the orthotic, is going to make a difference in their day-to-day life. So I'd recommend using pedometers or some type of way of figuring out what their community walking level is with and without the orthotic. And then also, I think it's interesting to watch the literature to see what we can learn about optimizing shank alignment and or shoe modifications to potentially optimize community walking in our patients.
That was Christy Bjornsson, Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Washington in Seattle and physical therapist at Seattle's Children's Research Institute. Now, what's the best way to help kids with Down syndrome learn how to ride a bike? The answer might just be co-op, short for Cognitive Orientation to Daily Occupational Performance. Joyce McGill-Evans from the University of Alberta co-authored a study in Pediatric Physical Therapy Journal about using co-op to help 6 adolescent girls and boys with intellectual disabilities learn motor skills.
What we did is we recruited 6 youth who were between the ages of 12 to 19 who had a diagnosis of Down syndrome and were unable to ride. And then we used a multiple baseline design to evaluate whether or not co-op was useful. And what we did is we measured the time and distance that they could ride 5 times before we gave them the intervention, and then we measured it 5 times after they'd had 7 or 8 sessions of co-op intervention. And so the intervention sessions, they were about 40 to 50 minutes, and each session started with having the youth decide what they wanted to work on or learn in during that session. So, for instance, they might choose how to start riding a bike, how to balance on a bike, or ride in a straight line, or something like that.
So there are a number of technical ways, important ways that new skills being learned. What results did you get from this?
What happened is we had youth who could ride no more than 1 meter at the beginning of the study, and even 2 meters after 5 times assessing them on bikes. And at the end, 5 of them, or about 83%, could ride over 100 meters at once without stopping. And they were consistently able to ride more than 30 meters, which is the usual outcome measure in most studies of cycling programs. And they could also stop independently, and 3 of them were able to start and navigate independently. And one of them even rode 1,400 meters, or about 8 minutes. But we did have one youth who remained unable to ride, so it wasn't effective for that young man.
So you got a good result then. What do you think was special about the co-op approach then?
Well, I think what was really special about it was it really involved the children in discovering what methods worked for them and their ability levels. So, for instance, one of the girls discovered her very own method of launching her bike, and what she did is she would push her bike forward with both feet several times and then put her feet on the pedals. And this was not an option that anyone had taught her. She just discovered it on her own. So again, we can learn from the children themselves, who understand what's the most comfortable way for them to do. So I think really collaborating with the children, and through a process that is called guided discovery, to let them find their own ways. And then they really feel that the sessions that they're involved in are meaningful.
So what do you think then are the practical lessons for everyday practice?
I think that looking at the use of co-op in pediatric practice with children, especially if they want to learn skills and activities that let them participate, so skills like biking or skills like playing basketball, or that kind of thing, I think it's a very useful approach for those children. And it works even for children who have intellectual disabilities like Down syndrome. But I think that one of the real keys is just having a collaborative approach and really letting the children have choice about what they want to be doing in each of the sessions, rather than following a prescribed sequence of teaching them skills.
On the line from Edmonton, that was Joyce McGill-Evans, Professor Emerita at the University of Alberta Department of Occupational Therapy. If a child walks by putting a toe down on the ground first instead of a heel, this could lead to problems ahead in life, with extra forces on the calf, Achilles tendon and the ball of the foot, all of which you might want to avoid. Well, physical therapist Claire Benke from Phoenix, Arizona, has been telling me about the study she's been working on using so-called distal vibration perception to identify the parameters involved in causing toe walking, and therefore giving information to help correct it if you decide to intervene.
We collected a number of children through contacts that we had at pediatric clinics throughout Phoenix that had been diagnosed with idiopathic toe walking. So they were not toe walking for any physiological reason. They didn't have tight heel cords. They didn't have cerebral palsy, anything like that. And we used a biothesiometer, which is a device that basically just applies a little bit of vibration, and you can increase it incrementally. So what we did is we had the children lay down in supine, and we tested them at their first MTP and the second MCP on both hands and both feet. We tested each site 3 times and then took an average of the number that we got. And basically what we found was that the children who toe walk, it took them longer to report that they were feeling the vibration, so they had a higher sensory threshold.
Right, so a higher threshold, what exactly does that imply?
From our standpoint, it seems that it takes them longer to feel the sensation. So the different theories that they're either going up on their toes to increase the sensory input, or they're going up on their toes to get away from the sensation. So from our results, it would suggests that they're going up on their toes to increase their sensory input because it takes them longer to feel the sensation.
Now, what do we learn from this then in terms of helping kids to develop optimally?
So the important thing is just to incorporate sensory considerations into your treatment. So you may want to assess whether they are hypersensitive or hyposensitive, and they have a short sensory profile out there, which we actually used in our study, that's parent report. It goes through a number of different categories, and it may be a good thing just to hand to your parents if you have a toe walker, just to consider whether they have some sensory differences. For us, we found on the sensory profile that 7% of our non-toe walkers were in the higher range on the short sensory profile, where 73% of our toe walkers were in the higher range. So it's a pretty significant difference.
Right, so the main take home for physiotherapists is what?
So I would say the main take home is that if you have an idiopathic toe walker in your clinic, it's important to consider that they may have altered sensation. You want to probably discuss with their parents if they're hypersensitive or hyposensitive, and kind of incorporate those sensory considerations into your treatment.
Claire Benke, working at Children's Rehabilitative Services in Phoenix, Arizona, and joining me now from the University of Southern California in Los Angeles via Sydney, Australia, is the Editor-in-Chief of Pediatric Physical Therapy, Linda Fetters. And Linda, I wonder what you make of some of those stories. First of all, the orthotics one, learning to walk, Christy Bjornsson.
Yes, hi, Peter. Study underscores the importance of assessing children in their typical life situations. The community use of orthotics that they used in their study. And I think we often talk about it. It's sometimes difficult to organize, to look at real world situations for the children that we serve. But this really underscores the importance of that. I would also like to see some information in future studies from Dr. Bjornsson as to the quality of the foot placement during ambulation. So did the orthotic change that in children who wore them versus didn't wear them?
These devices can be useful or cannot. How do we know when they're going to be useful?
Well, I think that's something that this study really helped to understand, or helped us understand, in that Dr. Bjornsson suggesting looking at specific characteristics of the orthotic. Obviously, they're not all created equal. We try to create an orthotic that's specific to the child and the child's needs. But there may be some specific features that need a bit more elaboration of what orthotics should include that really optimize community walking.
Okay, on to bike riding. It's fantastic to be able to ride a bike, and if you have Down syndrome, you can learn, says Joyce McGill-Evans. What do you make of all of that?
Well, I loved this approach to engaging the children, the adolescents, in this choice of exercise. How do they want to learn it? What was the best way for them to get involved? Because I think we all recognize that exercise isn't something that we all do spontaneously and with enthusiasm at times, that we really have to buy into an exercise program. And here, Dr. McGill-Evans recognizes that and assists the subjects in really buying into, getting engaged in their exercise program as opposed to telling them what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. So I really liked the creativity and this whole idea of self-discovery on the part of the children.
It's a guided learning, so they're actually coming up with original ideas themselves. They must get a lot of fulfillment from that too.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, this idea of vibration perception, what is that all about? It was a new one to me, toe walking, and how this gives you information about what's actually happening in the limbs. What's your assessment there?
Yeah, my assessment is that they've identified in this study, Dr. Benke and colleagues have identified the importance of sensory information for movement. And I believe that as physical therapists, we know that, we understand that. but probably need to be more mindful to measure it and relate it to the movement that we're observing. We do concentrate a lot on the production of movement, functional movement, and most likely we need to be focusing equally, if not more so, on the importance of sensory information, in this case, vibratory information for the children, sort of seeking information, I think, is what Dr. Behnke is suggesting, by walking on their toes to gain additional information.
And how much benefit do you think you can get by having some kind of intervention when you've monitored properly?
I think you can gain quite a bit when you've monitored properly, if you really understand the nature of the problem. So in this case, what is vibratory information helping the child do? What is vibratory information hindering in terms of movement? I think understanding the contribution of the sensory information is really critical to designing the intervention.
Okay, thanks, Linda. Well, let's crack on. I'd like to come back to you later for a comment on what I saw as a sort of theme running through some of the next stories from this latest edition of Pediatric Physical Therapy. Carpal tunnel syndrome, we read, has been detected in a morbidly obese teenager in a case report that appears in the journal from Kathleen Galloway from Nashville, Tennessee. And I asked her about her findings and about the significance of the finding of what is usually an adult syndrome in someone so young.
It was a patient that came in for an EMG, a nerve conduction test, which is a nerve test for carpal tunnel. And she was 13, which is kind of unusual to have. We don't normally see kids at all in that area of practice. I'm normally seeing adults. But she came in with that request, and it was just a little bit surprising. She came back, and she was morbidly obese. And I thought, well, I still don't think we'd find anything in somebody that young, so I was quite surprised that we did.
Right, so you did standard tests on her, and what conclusions did you come to?
That she essentially had, you know, median neuropathy at the wrist, and, you know, sent her back to the referring physician, and they diagnosed her with carpal tunnel syndrome, which would be what our test was consistent with.
Now, what's the big message coming out of this for you then as a physical therapist?
I think the general concern is that while we've seen obesity related to carpal tunnel syndrome in adults, it's usually something that takes time to develop. And I wonder in kids, if they're having a morbid obesity kind of problem, if it's creating more of a metabolic issue for them, and then that's creating, you know, the other comorbidities that we see with adult obesity, but now it's in a 13-year-old. And I just think, wow, you know, what's going to happen for her 30 years from now?
Right. Now, I'm beginning to see there's a sort of message in this, isn't there? And it's about obesity generally. What would you say is the message coming out of this?
I think the concern is that obesity is going to start having or creating these issues so much earlier. And I think it's scary for where the future may go for somebody who has developed those issues so early in life. From a PT point of view, I would guess that maybe we need to consider a little bit more about talking about activity levels and decreasing BMI in people with carpal tunnel syndrome, especially if they're that young, because in the long-term consequence, I don't know that it would get better if she isn't able to lower her body weight.
That was Kathleen Galloway, a professor at Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee. Baseline data on the physical capabilities of children with typical development have been clearly measured in research led by Adina Itzkowitz in the New York school system. She told me what they've been doing to put the much-respected timed up-and-go test through its paces in a large group of children to get first-hand working experience of how best to use this well-defined measure of childhood physical performance.
We tested about almost 1,500 students. Using the timed up-and-go test originally developed for adults by Pasiablo, we actually used his instructions, and we set up a 10-inch track, or 3 meters, with a bench at one end, and we asked the students to stand up, walk past towards the other line, turn around, come back, and sit back down, and we timed them.
Right. Now, you're looking at different ages, and you're looking at different BMIs, weren't you?
Yeah.
What were you looking for here?
we were looking to see if age or BMI would impact the speed, or even gender actually, would impact the speed of the Time's Up and Go.
And what did you find?
So interestingly enough, we found that BMI really, for the most part, did not affect tug scores at all. We had a slight uptick for the 8-9-year-olds, but there were a lot of variables that we did not think it was specifically geared towards the BMI. Our instructions were to walk at a natural, comfortable pace, and some of the when you do that, you can change the gait pattern of students because they may interpret that as walk really slow or not to run, which will impact gait.
Age was one of the factors you were looking at as well, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, and basically what we found was that from ages 5 through 9, we had a decrease in time, and then an increase in time from ages 9 to 13, which was really unexpected. So, but while it was statistically significant, it wasn't really clinically meaningful because the uptick was just a couple of tenths of a second.
Right, clinically meaningful. What are these outcomes telling you, though, about the test and about the children?
So clinically what it's telling us is that this test can be used in conjunction with classroom observations and other standardized tests to assist in making a decision when you're evaluating a student for physical therapy. The time it takes to stand up and walk 10 feet is similar to the time it would take a student to stand up from their desk and walk to a blackboard or a chalkboard or a smart board and sit back down. And if you see that that time is outside the expected norms for a student of a particular age, it would be a red flag for concern to further assess and see the cause of impact and if there are impact anywhere else in the school, in the child's daily school function.
Right. So what sort of practical message would you leave physical therapists with coming out of your study?
That they can use the Time's Up and Go test as one tool in their functional assessment for school-based therapy. It should not be used in and of itself as a standalone, but in conjunction with other studies, it will help to determine if the student is having difficulties functioning in their school environment.
Adina Itzkowitz, who works for the New York City Department of Education as their senior physical therapist and coordinator of clinical education. The issue of preventing weight gain has been addressed in a big school community-based study authored by Peggy Pope from Tallahassee, Florida, and published in Pediatric Physical Therapy. She found that you can intervene successfully with African-American children to help them avoid gaining weight. Peggy's team looked at BMI, blood pressure, and fitness levels in 222 school-aged children and at the perception kids had about their bodies. And the team then implemented programs of dietary and activity training that were successful.
For 2 years, we followed the children and we provided educational modules through the physical education class, information about how to design a healthy plate, for example. So I would talk to the children about making most of their plate green with vegetables or lettuce, and then a smaller portion with protein and a smaller portion with grains. We did other modules on how to create an active lifestyle when you don't have a lot of facilities in your community, because these children didn't. They were in a rural community. There was no YMCA. There were no gyms. So we talked about things like vacuuming, getting videotapes that were exercise videotapes that you could do during commercial breaks or with your mother, riding your bicycle around the house, doing yard work. You know, some of the chores that the kids did would be included as activity and burning calories, and I don't think they had thought about those activities as anything more than a chore.
Right. It sounds really interesting. It sounds really comprehensive as well. What was the effect of this very fascinating and broad-ranging intervention that you embarked upon then?
Well, we had a modest but practical goal of not gaining weight, you know, maintaining weight. And I said it was a modest goal because usually people are trying to lose weight if they're overweight or obese. But in fact, it's not all that easy to just maintain weight or slow down weight gain if you are overweight or obese. And when I talked to the dietitians, they said that for children, it's actually healthier, even if they are overweight or obese, it's healthier to maintain weight. Just don't gain weight, because when the children go through puberty and increase in height, they may come to a healthy body mass index just by maintaining their weight.
Right.
Because
now,
of the increased height.
How successful were you then?
Over the two-year period, the children at the intervention school maintained their weight. They did not increase their weight. So we achieved the goal. They were able to not gain weight as a group, 100 children.
What are the lessons then coming out of this, do you think, for other workers in health areas, including, of course, physical therapists?
Activity level that physical therapists are kind of specialized in is a crucial component of the multidisciplinary approach to weight management. I think a team needs to be involved in helping children who are overweight and obese manage their weight.
That was Peggy Pope, County Schools clinical physical therapist and adjunct professor at Florida A&M University. And I'd like to ask you, Linda Fetters, presently in Sydney, Australia, what do you make of some of these body weight issues? Let's start with the carpal tunnel syndrome and childhood obesity. That was a new one on me.
Yes, Peter, new for me also. And I think that what we're seeing in Kathleen Galloway's study is this awareness of the large sample of children, adolescents who have increased weight, are obese, and the long-term health consequences of lifetime obesity. I think she's really raised that issue in this case. And we see that in her case study, but then also in Adina and Peggy's study of looking at the impact of body size on a lifetime of ability and disability, and the importance of maintaining a healthy BMI that we probably have underappreciated in terms of the health consequences of for children and youth with being overweight and subsequently being obese.
Why do you think the TUG test didn't change for kids who were overweight in Adina's trial?
That's an interesting question. I would like to see more of an investigation in the future on the importance of speed in not only that test, the TUG test, but in other activities of daily life for adolescents. Often movements are required that are fast, getting from point A to point B rapidly, or children and adolescents make them fast. And I think we may see more of an effect on overall timing of movement when increased speed is required for different activities.
It was rather interesting, wasn't it, that Peggy, number one, was successful. It was very, very good to hear that you could prevent kids gaining weight. Also, the fact that if they simply maintain their weight and wait for their growth spurt to shoot up a bit of height, they can correct their BMI. Is that the way of thinking, do you think?
Well, I think that's something that needs to be investigated. I think it's a very interesting idea, and certainly preventing additional weight gain is important. And I think it would be interesting to see in the future if, in fact, what Peggy is suggesting actually occurs, and that is as these children go through puberty, they develop a normal BMI if they continue to maintain the weight as they did in her program.
Now, it seems to me that physical therapists have an overarching involvement with the community on this question of activity, active living. What do you think physical therapists around the world could perhaps be doing to be a bit more proactive in holding back this huge tide of childhood obesity?
Physical therapy is a very important discipline as a member of the team of people that, as Peggy's pointed out, is needed to assist children, adolescents, families in healthy eating, healthy lifestyle, and weight management. This really does require a team of professional people supporting families, because it's certainly a very big challenge.
A big challenge indeed. Well, thanks for that, Linda. That's all for this edition. We'll be back with more in 3 months' time. So until then, that's Linda Fetters from the University of Southern California and, of course, via Australia at the moment. And from me, Peter Goodwin, in the Paediatric Physical Therapy Studio. Goodbye.
Goodbye, Peter.